completely excludes the territory of Russian Federation has been established since 2018. This route has been successfully used before, and we are prepared to utilize it should the necessity arise. Moreover, one should not forget that Kazatomprom also has existing inventory at Western converters and the possibility to swap material if needed. To underscore once again, we have seen no impact to our transit deliveries, but we are fully prepared to address any possible changes with multiple options and tools at our disposal. Regarding sanctions, I would like to say that Kazakhstan is not a target to any direct Western sanctions. The British government, for example, has confirmed to Kazakh officials that it has no intention to impose sanctions against Kazakhstan due to the recent events in Ukraine. Moreover, we see a very careful approach to the energy sector, particularly nuclear fuel and its components, even from countries with the hardest sanction policies towards Russia. There is ongoing work with plans in place to mitigate the sanction risk, and we work with a partner to restructure as needed to avoid such sanctions. We are monitoring the situation very closely and consider various options for risk mitigation. And on this note, I would like to conclude my presentation. Thank you everyone for your attention.
And now we bring you the final presentation of the day. Paul Ma of CGN Mining joins us. He's the Director of Capital Operations of the company. CGN engages in trading of natural uranium and property investments, and the company is headquartered in Hong Kong.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Ma from CGN Mining. It's a great pleasure for me to take part in today's conference and share with you guys my views on the uranium market. So I'm going to start with my views on the nuclear power market first. By March 8th, there are 439 operable reactors with 390 gigawatts capacity. That accounts for 4% of the global installed power generating capacity. Despite only accounts for 4% of global installed capacity, nuclear power accounts for 10% of global electricity consumption. Why? Not only because nuclear is safe, clean, carbon-free, but also because it is economic favorable. For example, a study on the US utilities in the last decade shows that the operating cost of the nuclear power only second to hydropower, and nuclear power's fuel cost is only 30% of the fossil fuel and gas power. In 2011, Fukushima gives a heartbeat to the then dynamic development of nuclear power. Yet, as we can see today, 29 reactors commenced operation from 2012 to 2016. Another 41 reactors commenced operation from 2017 to 2022. 12 or 40 more reactors were connected to the grid in the last 5 years compared with the first 5 years after Fukushima. This means Fukushima did slow down the growth rate of the nuclear power, but it didn't change the trend of nuclear power. Like it or not, nuclear power is a must in the future. Besides the installed nuclear capacity, there are 56 gigawatts nuclear power under construction. 96 gigawatts nuclear power have been planned, and another 353 gigawatts nuclear power have been proposed. In the next 5 years, 38 reactors represent 43 gigawatts are expected to be connected to the grid, while another 23 reactors represent 70 gigawatts are expected to be shut down, including three German reactors which are targeting to shut down by the end of this year. Given consideration to the global consensus on carbon peak and carbon neutrality, the surging price of fossil fuel and the mature of the third generation nuclear power, the development of nuclear power is expected to accelerate in the future. In another word, the demand for uranium will increase in the long run as well. China has a very ambitious nuclear power program. The government annual report says that China will develop nuclear power actively and orderly under the precondition of safety. It has been made public in its 14th five-year plan that the installed nuclear capacity is expected to be 70 gigawatts by 2025, a 40% increase in 5 years. Moreover, according to China Nuclear Energy Association, there will be 100 gigawatts nuclear power by 2030 and 150 by 2035. Some people used to doubt whether China will insist on nuclear power because China suspended the approval of new reactors after Fukushima. There was zero approval of new reactors from 2015 to 2017. Actually, China has never given up on nuclear power. The regulators were just waiting for the mature of third generation nuclear power technology, which will bring the safety standard of nuclear power to a brand new level and contribute to the public acceptance to nuclear power. 2018 is a big year for nuclear power. Typical third generation technology, including EPR, AP1000, HPR1000, commenced commercial operation respectively, which proved the design and operation of third generation technology is feasible and realistic. As a result, the approval of new reactors restarted by the end of 2018 in China. From 2018 to 2021, China has approved the construction of 15 new reactors, including one SMR. Although China is very serious in nuclear power, we have a lot of catch up to do. For instance, nuclear power only accounts for 4.6% of China's electricity consumption in 2020, less than half of the world average level. The good news for China and the uranium industry is that Chinese reactors are very young, with a designed life of 60 years. Only 3 out of the 54 reactors aged more than 20 years, and 41 out of the 54 aged less than 10 years. The Chinese government have made its commitment on carbon peak by 2030 and carbon neutrality by 2060. Nuclear will definitely be an unavoidable part of the solution. Yes, we do have a lot of new builds on renewable energies as well, such as wind, solar, hydropower. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there is no room for nuclear power. Nuclear power is a source of power which can combine the advantages of fossil energy and renewable energy. It is baseloadable, economic viable, and environment friendly. I believe there will be more and more countries, more and more people realize the advantages of nuclear power, overcome the fear of nuclear power as a continuous improvement of the technology. Nuclear power will definitely play a more important role in the global energy sector in the future. I have spent so many time to explain why nuclear power have a bright future. Now it is time to discuss what this means to uranium industry. Uranium is a highly concentrated industry. 75% of the world's uranium production comes from 4 uranium abundant areas. Kazakhstan owns 15% of the global resources, but Kazakhstan provides 40% of the global production volume, while Australia owns 28% of the world resources, but only provides 13% of the global production volume. The resources burn rate in Kazakhstan is so high that we should pay close attention to whether to provide 40% of production from 17% of resources scenario is healthy and sustainable in the long run. Even Kazatomprom, the most cost-competitive producer, utilized 80% of its capacity in the past few years because they are not happy with the current price. As for Australia, despite there are a lot of resources, most of them are byproduct of copper in Olympic Dam. This means that the production volume of uranium will have to follow the production volume of copper. The production site is very fragile. There is an objective mismatch in timing and location in uranium market. Regarding the timing, the designed life of a reactor is usually 60 years, 80 years for the third generation technology. But the life of the uranium mines usually lasts only 10 to 20 years. One reactor needs successive support from multiple uranium mines to ensure the lifelong uranium supply. Regarding the location, as you can see in the chart below, the major nuclear power country produces very few uranium, and the major uranium production countries consumes very few uranium. The nuclear countries have to buy and the uranium producers have to sell in the international market. This means international trade and investment activities will dominate the supply and the demand of uranium market. This objective fact increases the risk of the uranium market, especially under today's international political and economic pattern. Besides the mismatch in timing and location, uranium supply itself has already been in deficit in the last decade. What is more is that the demand of uranium is increasing on a yearly basis in the future, while the production volume of the existing mines will begin to decrease after 2030. It seems very long from now to 2030, but if you think about it, it surely take 5 to 10 years to build a uranium mine. Actually, the time to build replacement capacity is very tight. Don't mention that there is a potential risk the secondary supply will change into secondary demand to compensate the ponds which have been consumed to satisfy the gap between the supply and demand as the uranium price surges. To satisfy the nuclear power with primary supply from the mines, in another word, to produce 180 million pounds a year, we need a price at least at $50 per pound. Due to the long-lasting low uranium price since Fukushima, many production capacity have been reduced or suspended. The producing volume cannot satisfy the demand right now. We have seen some improvement on the supply side in parallel with the recent development of the uranium price, but the capex in new uranium exploration and development is still at historic low. It takes time before the new production capacity can enter into the market, but significant amount of production volume are expected to be removed from the market around 2030. In this chart, you can see there are some very interesting unreasonable facts in uranium market. I have selected the year 2011, 2016, and 2021 for comparison. In 2011, the installed nuclear capacity was 380 gigawatts. The uranium price was $72 per pound, while the global production volume was 138 million pounds. In 2016, the installed capacity was 393 gigawatts, 13 gigawatts higher than that of 2011. But the uranium price hit decades low, just $17 per pound in 2016. The producer produced 164 million pounds in 2016, 26 million pounds higher than that of 2011. Well, the price of 2016 is only a quarter of that of 2011. After 2016, the price begins to recover. In 2021, the price was $42 per pound. The production volume is only 125 million pounds a year, 39 million pounds less than that of 2016. But the price of 2021 is $25 higher than that of 2016. These facts are against the economics law. And that is why we see the trends of actual uranium price have beaten the expectations in the past few years. As you can see, the index provider has raised the price forecast several times in the past, but the actual uranium price has always gone beyond the expectation. When I was preparing for this presentation, the spot price was 52.50 cents on March 8th, but now it is $60 per pound. It is very hard to predict tomorrow's uranium price, but it is not that hard to predict the uranium price for the next year or even further if you think about what happened in the nuclear market and what is happening in the uranium supply side. So that is what I want to share with you guys regarding my study and my understanding on the global nuclear power market. And also from the uranium supply side, you know, what do I see in the future? So maybe it is very hard to predict the uranium price of tomorrow, but it is not that hard to predict the uranium price in the long run. I believe there is a long way for the uranium market to recover in the future, in the years to come. Lastly, given today's opportunity, I'd like to introduce a little bit about my company to you guys as well, CG Mining. CG Mining is the only uranium producer backed by a nuclear power group. So it means that we are not only a producer, we are also an end user. This gives us a very unique opportunity because one, there is a potential capacity cooperation opportunity. You know, we are not a competitor to the asset owner, but also we are a customer, so we have the advantages. This allows us to own several producing in-situ leachable uranium mines in Kazakhstan. And also, we are the only listed uranium company in Asia currently, and we are one of the major uranium producer listed companies around the world, which is profitable. Currently, our realized sales price is among the highest around our peers, and we enjoy the lowest production costs because all of our production came from the in-situ leachable producing mines in Kazakhstan. And last year, we have just finished the acquisition of Central Mangkuduk and Arctic Lake. And in the next 3 years to come, our share of production are expected to grow by 124%. So it's a huge increase. Currently, CG Mining is a very small company, but it has the potential to become a major producer in the future, especially when CG Power is the largest nuclear constructor around the world. And we have been listed into many indexes, and we have been a targeting company of all the major uranium ETFs. CG Mining is made up of two parts. One is the mining part, and also we have a trading part as well. Regarding the mining part, we own three subsidiaries, and we own three producing mines in Kazakhstan: Semzbay, Irko, and Central Mangkuduk. Semzbay and Irko is producing at $80 per pound, and Central Mangkuduk is producing at an even lower cost, only $12 per pound. All these three mines are very cost competitive, are the most cost competitive mines around the world. Regarding Jaopark, Jaopark have obtained subsoil use contract at last year, and the mining construction will commence in this year. It will reach the designed capacity by 2025, 750 tons a year. Besides our projects in Kazakhstan, we also own 15% of Fission, the owner of PLS project, one of the world's most advanced undeveloped high-grade project, which must have a very bright future. So all these projects is a very well-balanced portfolio, which can give CG Mining the capability to provide its customer with sustainable, cost-competitive supplies in the long run. Besides the mining part, the trading part, we have a fully owned subsidiary in London. It's called CGN Global Uranium Company. And the trading volume of CGN Mining ranks top three around the world. Last year, the selling volume is more than 4,000 tons a year. That's all what I want to share with you guys today. Thank you for your attention. It is a pity that I cannot take part in the meeting personally because of the pandemic. I wish every success to the conference, and I hope we have more chance to communicate with each other in the future. If you have more questions, please contact the contact information as listed in the screen. Thank you.
And that was Paul Ma of CGN Mining. And now we're opening up the floor to questions for Rick Rule. I know that many of you have questions for Rick as we edge closer to the conclusion of today's Uranium Bootcamp. You can go to the Q&A section of the event tab on Hopin and just make sure you're on the stage section, which you can confirm by looking at the left-hand column. We'll try to get to as many questions as possible, so start typing away. But before we get to the Q&A, let's go over some ground rules. Rick is here and he'll fill you in on his ground rules for questions.
First of all, I need to say there's 3,300 of you here, and it seems like each of you have three questions. The probability that I'm going to get through 9,000 questions in 30 minutes is nil. Albert and I have made an executive decision, which is to say that the questions that we're not able to answer today, we'll try to record answers to over the next 2 or 3 weeks. And we'll distribute links to that. So we're going to do a Q&A session, a recorded Q&A session, over the next 2 or 3 weeks. And we'll distribute links so that we can answer as many questions as is possible, given the fact that there's almost no possibility that we're going to be able to answer the volumes of questions that we're going to get today. The second is that I don't want to answer any company-specific questions, which A, might be construed as investment advice, and particularly I'm not going to answer questions about companies that didn't exhibit here. One of the common features of these online forums is that financial public relations executives from companies that didn't pay a fee to appear try to get their name inserted in a forum like this, which is something that we're not going to entertain. It's also very possible, given the number of questions that I'm going to be asked, that I won't know the answer, in which case, Remy, I'm just going to say, I don't know. With that, let's get started.
Well, Rick, I think that's really sensible, and you do have lots of questions in the Q&A section, so let's start out really broad here. I'm going to take a question from C.K. Lim, and saying there is obvious demand for uranium, but we're seeing share prices higher for miners. He's asking, are we already in overvalued territory, and do we have to wait for fundamentals to catch up?
I would argue that given almost the inevitability of higher uranium prices, that we aren't in overvalued territory. What I might say, however, is that we've identified 72 companies that purport to be in the uranium space, and only 12 of the 72 that we have found we believe are investable. So if you follow from that the fact that probably 60 companies in the space have no value whatsoever, there are a lot of small companies, mercifully none of which we allowed to exhibit with us, that are perpetually overvalued because they're worth nothing. What that means is that you have to do stock selection. But certainly, as we'll discover later in this discussion, the uranium sales price worldwide is still lower than the total cost of production worldwide. The uranium price has to go up. But as a consequence of that, I think there's still room left in the uranium stocks. I think it's important to note, too, that while the people that are involved in this discussion are all deeply involved in uranium, around the world, investor participation in the uranium space is very, very, very small. So I think there's still room to run in select issues.
Well, Rick, before we get to the other questions, there is one about geopolitics, in particular with the situation with sanctions and Russia. And Dennis is asking that with Russia out of the enrichment play, what do you expect to see in terms of who will be filling this void to refine, enrich, as well as convert?
In the near term, fortunately or unfortunately, it takes a long time to build out enrichment space. And so 40% of enrichment capacity, one could argue, just went to capacity heaven, which is to say, while the Russians will still be enriching uranium, the fact is that given the geopolitical concerns, there is going to be a shortfall in capacity. And what that means is that a situation where the enrichers underfed, which is to say they scraped every available molecule out of existing fuel, they're going to overfeed now because there's a shortage of capacity, which will probably exacerbate in the near term the shortage for uranium. The direct answer to the question is nobody's going to fill the void in the next little while. The Russians will continue, I think, to enrich, and they will continue to stockpile. But the truth is that supplies are going to be tighter than they otherwise would have been as a consequence of geopolitical concerns around Russia and the Ukraine.
Okay, Rick, moving on to a question that came in earlier from Matthew Lenton. This has been gaining in popularity, so I'll ask you this question. He is asking, what are the most important metrics when it comes to the proper evaluation of speculative miners?
That's a tough question. We could spend 8 hours on that, but I'll try and confine my answer to 2 minutes. I'm interested, as Lobo said, in the delta between price and value. So what I try to do is I model out an expected net present value, which is to say, in an exploration company, I look at the size of the prize, the target size. I look at the probabilities of them obtaining that target size. And I try to figure out then what the net present value of the cash flows that would come from the target if they were successful. Obviously, you need to risk adjust this. But money's made on the difference between the price and value. As an example, if there's a high probability of a company developing 100 million pounds, and that company could produce those pounds for $30 a pound, and you expect the selling price to be $60 a pound, the margin will be $30 a pound. If you discount that $30 a pound back, measuring out how many years from now it'll be produced, you get a very rough sense of the net present value of future cash flows. From that, of course, you must deduct the capital costs, and you develop a target net present value. As Lobo said, you never get it right with models, but it's important to have a valuation basis to begin with. So from my viewpoint, the most important determinant is the delta between net present value and market price, understanding that you'll never get it right, that you operate merely in parameters around that. I think, too, increasingly in junior companies, expertise is going to matter. I think there's going to be a real shortage of skilled operators in the uranium space. There's going to be a shortage of traders. There's going to be a shortage of mine builders. There's going to be a shortage of mine operators. There's going to be a shortage of explorers. And I think the resumes of the people involved in the junior companies, resumes specific to the task at hand, will be a very, very important determinant. Had you asked me the question 3 years ago, I would have said access to capital. But it seems now, given the newfound political favor of uranium, that companies will be able to access capital. Certainly, a company that says that they're going to build a project must be able to tell you, relative with some certainty at least, what the project will cost to build, and be able to tell you where and how they're going to access the capital that's necessary to build it.
And Rick, before we move on to the other questions that are coming through on the platform, I have a question for you. I know that we've met a lot of the exhibitors in person as well as through the hybrid model, but given that you've sat through these presentations as well as moderated some of these panels, were there any surprises from the speakers and the companies?
For me, no, because I've been involved in most of these companies since inception, and I've continually visited with them. I think the thing that really set this symposium apart from other junior mining symposiums was the presence at this symposium of WMC, the presence in this symposium of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which is probably the most important spot market determinant in the sector, and of course the presentations by Cameco, Kazatomprom, and CGN. So I think in this circumstance, it wasn't so much the junior presentations as the quality of the keynote presentations that made the difference. Understand that this was a very curated list of presenters. In most functions like this, the determinant as to whether or not you can present is whether or not, as an exhibitor, your check cashes. We were much more discriminating. These companies had to be owned in Sprott-managed accounts or in my own account. Which doesn't guarantee that the stocks will go up, but it does guarantee that we know the companies well enough that we own them with our own money. So what you found is a uniformly high-quality group of exhibitors.
I think that's really key, Rick. Now I'll take a question that just came through from Alex Drummond, and they are asking, what are some of the factors that could change the value proposition for producers?
Well, one thing would be a dramatic increase or decrease in the uranium price. We need to take into account that absent one factor, it's almost inevitable that uranium prices go higher. What every uranium investor or speculator has to have in the back of his or her mind is if we have another nuclear plant problem, if we have a Chernobyl, if we have a Three Mile Island, if we have a Fukushima, you need to have in the back of your mind the fact that a nuclear accident, while extremely improbable, given the advancements in technologies and the safeguards that are put in place, to the extent that we did have a nuclear accident, obviously that would impact the favorable political winds that are in uranium's favor now. On the other side, what we've seen is that the supply side in uranium is very concentrated. And to the extent that political difficulties with Russia, as an example, continue, the ability that we would have for supply disruptions are extremely large. An example would be a labor stoppage or some other form of interruption of production at Olympic Dam, which is one of the largest uranium companies, producers in the world, where uranium is produces a byproduct. The fact is, as we have learned, the supply chain in uranium is extremely skinny. And any interruption to that supply chain could obviously send prices soaring. So there's the potential for supply changes and demand changes that are probably extraneous to most of the discussions that we could have here. And I think that's something that investors need to keep in mind.
And Rick, now we'll take a question from John Luke. He is asking about your outlook for the future of thorium reactors.
I think that we discussed that a little bit earlier on talking with WMC. Thorium, in my own experience, has been a wonderful substance to sell newsletters. There are people who have been predicting a boom in thorium for as long as I have been in the space. I don't personally understand technically as well as I wish I did the difference between thorium-based energy production and uranium-based energy production. But I can tell you this, if you look around the world, several hundred billion dollars is being invested in uranium reactors. And as far as I know, the only investments that are taking place in thorium reactors are pilot projects in China and India, which suggests that if thorium does have a role to play, it has a role to play 20 years from now or 30 years from now. The net present value of a disruption that happens in 20 or 25 years in today's dollars is zero.
Okay, Rick, now moving on to the next question, I'll take one coming through Stefan van der Gag, and he is asking, what do you think about the recent recommendation to put LME to suspend all commodity deliveries from Russia, in particular copper, aluminum, as well as nickel?
Geopolitics isn't my beat. The truth is that if we were going to suspend trade with various countries around the world as a consequence of the fact that they did things we wouldn't like, the trade would be extraordinarily disruptive. My hope is that saner heads prevail in Russia and the Ukraine, and they are able to announce some form of armistice in the immediate future, and not merely for economic reasons. War is a horrific outcome in any circumstance, and this one is no exception. Beyond that, I think we all have a need, once the hostilities are over, with some conditions, to begin the process of communication with the Russians. I think Mr. Putin needs to be left an exit ramp. He needs to have some reason, some excuse, some incentive to do the right thing. And should he do the right thing, obviously it's going to be necessary to re-engage with the Russians. So my hope is that any disruption in relations with Russia and the rest of the world, conditional, of course, on Russia's return to decent behavior, would be tempered with the fact that we need to continue to engage in order for there to be peace between our peoples.
And Rick, now we'll take a question on carbon credits. Pavel Kozlov is asking about your take on carbon credits and how you expect it to affect the uranium industry.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think maybe they're two different questions. The carbon credit market is obviously expanding very, very rapidly, and I think can be continued to expand. I would note that there seems to be a new carbon credit deal announced in capital markets every day. And my suspicion is that right now carbon credit companies are trading more on narrative than value. And while I think that there's a lot of upside in the carbon markets generally, I can't comment so much on the speculative appeal, or rather the speculative value around carbon companies. It remains to be seen whether the big thinkers in the world will allow nuclear power plants, new built nuclear power plants, to claim carbon credits. The claim would revolve around how much carbon didn't get generated relative to the amount of power that does get generated by a nuclear power plant. Certainly, carbon credits have been issued in the past to geothermal producers, solar producers, and wind producers. And there's absolute logic that to the extent that you're going to issue carbon credits for foregone carbon production, that the nuclear power industry should benefit. Whether the politics of that will be acceptable to the big thinkers of the world is a very different question, well above my pay grade.
And Rick, now we'll move on to a company-specific question that just came in a few minutes ago. You have a question about Kazatomprom's relative value in the space and your take in terms of the perceived macro risk.
I'm personally a large investor in Kazatomprom. I've taken political risk my whole life. And I have found in my life that not taking technical risk, which is to say buying very high quality companies that are in jurisdictions that other people find risky, has worked out for me. The idea that I would buy a third tier deposit in a so-called first tier company, country, isn't something that's worked out for me. Many people seem to favor low quality assets in high quality countries. I wonder about that. I wonder about developing an asset that nobody would bother to steal in a country that doesn't steal assets. It seems rather circular to me. So I'm a large relative to my portfolio, Kazatomprom shareholder, simply because they're the largest and lowest cost producer of uranium in the world. I'm also impressed, particularly with the younger management team around Kazatomprom, at the technical and financial decisions that they've made. This isn't investment advice. I'm telling you what I do with my own money. If you're the type of person that watches the nightly news too much and has your investment parameter determined by whether or not you can pronounce a country's name, or who its neighbors are, certainly avoid Kazatomprom. For me, the value proposition associated with its reserves, its resources, its production, and its cash margins, by the way, including its spectacular dividend, are too great to be ignored.
And Rick, now a big picture question coming from Jeremy Germain. So he is asking, are there any new nuclear technologies that you're watching?
Well, I don't know if you could call SMR, small modular reactors, as a new technology. I think the technology has been around 30 years. What's happening is that that technology is beginning to mature, and it's moving away from being a marginal or small technology to widespread adoption. I think that the ability of the power industry to, while they're building very, very, very large plants for baseload power, also develop smaller, less capital-intensive plants that have quicker paybacks to allow frontier markets, as an example, to access carbon-free, reliable baseload power, will, over the next 10 years, make an enormous change in nuclear power demand. Countries, particularly in emerging and frontier markets, that can't afford an $8 billion giga-reactor might easily be able to afford a $200 or $250 million SMR, and I expect that this technology will enjoy wide implementation. So the technology that's of most appeal to me, I wouldn't describe as a new technology. I would rather describe it as a technology that's being deployed at an industry-wide scale now.
Okay, Rick, now moving on to another question that's coming through the Q&A section. This is more about commodities and crude oil. So Stephen Chu is asking if there's any correlation or influence when it comes to crude oil and the price of uranium, historically speaking.
Historically, I think they've been disconnected simply because uranium has been a fairly small fuel relative to oil. Certainly over time, there's correlation between the two because any source of energy is correlated. I think that you will see more correlation between the price of liquefied natural gas, seaborne liquefied natural gas, and uranium. One example would be post-Fukushima, when the Japanese shut down their nuclear power fleet and had to replace that baseload power with peaking power that came from burning seaborne liquefied natural gas. The worldwide price of seaborne liquefied natural gas for a while quintupled. So what I think you're going to see is increasing prices and decreasing supplies of natural gas, increasing the acceptance for uranium, maybe not the price for uranium, but the acceptance for uranium. It's important to note a historical precedent for this. The Japanese decision to focus their future energy needs on uranium occurred in the early part of the decade of the 70s as a consequence of the Arab oil embargo. Because Japan has very limited natural resources, and particularly limited resources with regards to energy, the Arab oil embargo hit Japan particularly hard during a period of very, very, very aggressive economic growth. The consequence of that is that the Japanese made a policy decision to focus on nuclear because of its energy density, because the possession of a fairly small amount of uranium could power Japanese industrial might for a very long period of time. You could store enough uranium to power Japan for 5 years, where you couldn't store that much liquefied natural gas, you couldn't store that much coal, and certainly you couldn't store that much rain. And I think that the geopolitical concerns we've seen around oil and gas in Europe, as an example, will mean that uranium will enjoy favor relative to fossil fuels simply because of energy security reasons.
What we're seeing in terms of price action for uranium producer stocks. So Ray asked a question about why uranium producer stocks seem to be lagging behind recent increases in the price of uranium compared to previous increases that we've seen in the uranium space.
Well, I would argue, I would question the premise. I think we saw uranium producer and particularly uranium explorer prices increase disproportionately relative to the price of uranium until 7 or 8 months ago when they fell precipitously. The recent increases in uranium prices that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 weeks have been marked, I think, with concurrent increases in the price of the uranium producers, with the exception, of course, of the price of Kazatomprom, which has stayed depressed as a consequence of its transshipment risk through Russia and the fact that it's perceived, given that it was a former member of the CIS, which is to say a former Russian possession, I think that that price has been probably unduly depressed as a consequence of political risk. But I wouldn't argue that the price of uranium stocks and uranium producers has been constrained, particularly relative to the uranium price. I need to say that I personally believe that the uranium price will continue to increase. So I'm not saying either that the uranium stocks are overpriced, but I am saying that I believe that by any objective measure, they've kept pace with the uranium price.
Okay, Rick, now there's a question regarding uranium projects. This is about inflation as well as interest rate hikes, all things that we've been paying attention to recently, not just in the US, but also overseas. So David Rosticker is asking, how will inflation and hikes in interest rates, as well as some of the supply chain issues that we're seeing affect uranium projects? And based on your response to that, how has that been factored in, if at all?
That's a great question. I have been modeling uranium companies based on an incentive price at $60 a pound. But the inflation that we're seeing in the supply chains constructing mines in other mineral commodities around the world suggests that the $60 incentive price will be replaced in fairly short order by a $70 or $75 price. This occurs not only as a consequence of disruptions in the supply chain and increases in the price of things like steel, but also because of skilled labor shortages around the world. It's important to note, too, that uranium is an extremely political fuel. And delays in permitting, which are experienced around the world, obviously impact the net present value because they delay the receipt of cash flows. It's important to note, too, that in extractive industries around the world, I would argue in all industries around the world, the social take, which is to say the greed of governments, taxation, royalties, regulation, offsite costs are increasing very rapidly. So it isn't just the fact that we'll see inflation in capital costs, you will also see inflation in operating costs in terms of the government take. Finally, these are capital-intensive businesses. To the extent that the interest rate goes up, the interest charge goes up. All of this will mean that companies that have existing producing assets or companies that control assets that are permitted and built and can be returned cheaply to market will have an advantage over the developers.
And Rick, while we're on the topic of governments, we have a question coming in regarding what we're seeing in terms of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, none of us have a crystal ball, but we have a question regarding this conflict. And what do you think will happen if we do get a resolution in this conflict? Do you think that will affect uranium miners positively or negatively, if at all?
That's above my pay grade. I wish we would have had the opportunity to ask Secretary Abraham that question. The politics of uranium, well, politics itself has confounded me for 40 years. Certainly, if we had internal political disruption in Russia, that would have widespread implications through many, many, many commodity sectors. I think there's ample supplies of non-Russian uranium, but given the fact that 40% of the world's enrichment capacity takes place in Russia, continued disruption in enrichment capacity would have a real impact in uranium prices. Let's pray that any continued political disruption in Russia is contained in some fashion peacefully, that the will of the Russian people is observed, but it's observed with as little bloodshed as is humanly possible.
Okay, Rick, well, we have time for one more question. Now, given that this is a uranium boot camp, for those of the attendees out there who may be fairly new to the market, as well as for experienced investors out there, what is one message or advice that you have to the attendees out there?
Two. The first is work. Too many people own uranium stocks based on the premise, got a hunch, bet a bunch. That doesn't work. If I had a criticism of the uranium portfolios that I've graded over the last 2 years, it would be that most people owned too many uranium stocks and didn't know enough about each company. Familiarize yourself with the companies. To the extent that you don't understand the company well enough, don't buy the company. Figure out who you're going to listen to and why you're going to listen to them. The second thing is, this is a rodeo ride. As Justin said, these companies can move up or down by 20% in a day. If you have the courage of your convictions, if you understand why you own a company, you are likely to buy more of it when it declines in price, and you're likely to sell some when it increases in price. The way that you make money is buying low and selling high. And having the courage of your conviction means that you have a conviction. Having a conviction means that you did the work, that you did study. Do the work, be prepared for volatility, take advantage of volatility. Don't let volatility take advantage of you.
Well, thank you, Rick, for taking the questions today. And thank you to all of the attendees and viewers for sending in your questions. And now we're heading into the final segment of today's event. Rick, I'll turn it over to you for your closing remarks as we wrap up today's Uranium Investors Bootcamp.
Great. I'd like to begin, first of all, by thanking all of you, 3,300 people around the world who took 8 hours out of their day or 8 hours out of the next several days. Delighted to have you with us. I'd like to thank, too, my keynote speakers and my exhibitors that made today possible. But in particular, I'd like to thank the staff of the Uranium Bootcamp, everybody who was involved in making all this as seamless as it was. particularly Albert and Remy. The fact that I look so calm has to do with the fact that Albert looks so stressed. And so I'm delighted with all of the support that I enjoyed from the staff of this uranium boot camp. What did we learn? Well, I think we learned something really from every speaker. So let's go over. Let's remember back to the WMC presentation. The important thing that we learned there, other than how uranium and nuclear fuel works, is the fact that the price of uranium worldwide is less than the fully loaded cost of production. And the fully loaded cost of production, as we learned, is increasing rapidly. What that means is that the price of uranium has to go up, because if the price of uranium doesn't go up, we'll have a short supply, we'll have a shortfall in supply, and literally in some countries, the United States included, the lights will go out. Another important thing that we learned is that the price for the uranium, that is the cost of the uranium that goes into a nuclear power plant, is a fairly small part of the operating cost of the plant, typically under 5%, which means if the price of uranium goes up, it doesn't really change the price or the cost, pardon me, to produce the output of a plant. Think through this, folks. If the price of something has to go up and the price of something can go up, the price of something will go up. I think the first thing that we learned from the first part of this presentation from WMC is that the price has to go up, the price can go up, and as a consequence of that, the price will go up. We also looked at normalized supply of uranium, the supply shortfalls from uranium as were identified by WMC mining, relative merely to the permitted and financed reactors. This doesn't talk about the planned or prayed for reactors looking forward, but rather increases in demand from plants that were otherwise slated for shutdown that won't be, Japanese restarts, and plants that have already been financed and permitted. The fact that there's basically no way to accommodate their demand for uranium from existing supplies suggests, of course, that the future for uranium will be bright. The second keynote speaker, of course, was John Champaglia. I would argue that the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust is probably the most important near-term determinant of uranium prices in the market. And from John, we learned a really interesting thing, which is to say that investor interest in uranium worldwide is very strong and expected to increase. It's worthy to note that Sprott enjoys about 300,000 shareholders in their various physical trusts, and introducing that existing base of investors to uranium has had a dramatic impact on the uranium price. John didn't say this, but my suspicion is if they are successful in listing that product on the New York Stock Exchange, that the increased trading liquidity will allow the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust to continue to have the outsize impact on the uranium market that it has already had. From Spencer Abraham, we learned about the politics of energy and the politics of uranium too. We talked about the political difficulties around all fossil fuels, not merely domestic problems, but geopolitical concerns around the world. But with specific regards to uranium, we've learned a couple things politically, which is to say, for the first time in my life, at least, as a consequence of carbon, uranium is becoming a politically correct fuel. There are young people or older people who previously were hostile to uranium, including the co-founder of Greenpeace, who believe that uranium is the answer to increasing availability of electricity for those people around the world who don't have access to it in a way that doesn't generate carbon. It's obvious that you're going to see increased demand for electricity of all kinds around the world. As Mr. Abraham said, remember that 1.2 billion people in the world have no access to electricity now, and another 2 billion people experience energy poverty. All these people want access to the same lifestyle that you and I have, and this requires electricity. I read something in the news today that said that people in the United States use more electricity heating their pools than is consumed in the entire nation of Uganda. We're going to need more of all forms of electricity, uranium, of course, among them. But the big change, the big near-term change in the politics of uranium has to do, of course, with geopolitical concerns. Disruption of uranium from Russia, disruption of oil and gas from Russia, the difficulties in security of supply for energy around the world. The consequence of that is that people are increasingly attracted to the strategic aspects of uranium. From the big company producers, the other keynote speakers, we learned something that's just, invaluable, which is to say, these companies have learned the lesson with regards to how they schedule supply. Supply in the future will be tied to contract prices that allow existing shareholders reasonable returns on capital employed. This was echoed by every single producer, by Grant Isaac from Cameco, from Kazatomprom, who probably has the largest uncommitted developable reserves in the place. And we learned the same thing from Paul Ma from CGN, but from CGN, we also learned that uranium is an important part of the ongoing energy mix in China, the world's fastest growing energy consumer. I think the consequence of what we learned is all very bullish with regards to uranium. The price can go up, the price must go up, so the price will go up. Politically, uranium has gone from a political pariah to, while not a darling, politically acceptable. The industry will evidence financial discipline and will have production discipline too, which leaves room not just for them, but also for the developers and the explorers going forward. I've also received numerous questions to me before the event about the construction of uranium portfolios. I'm delighted to say that my former colleagues at Sprott are going to come out with a managed product around uranium, and I'm going to assist them with the construct of those portfolios. Any of you who care to receive information concerning these Sprott uranium equities portfolios are advised to get in touch with me. You do that by email at contact@ruleinvestmentmedia.com. contact@ruleinvestmentmedia.com. While you're in the process of contacting me, I would love it if any of you who enjoyed today's presentation, or any of you who didn't enjoy today's presentation, gave us topics for discussion in future boot camps. Do you want to know about silver? Do you want to know about exploration? Those of you who have been to our various conferences over the years know that our attendees are the ones who drive the conferences of the future. And these boot camps are no exception. If there are topics that you would like us to discuss, including other aspects of uranium, email us, contact@ruleinvestmentmedia.com. In closing, Remy, Albert, staff, exhibitors, people, thank you so much. We, as I say, will answer more questions in the weeks to come, and we will email all of you links so that you can have access to the questions that didn't get answered today. I hope that all of you find today's session useful. I know that you're going to have to review it again because there was an awful lot of information. I hope, in fact, I trust that the consequence of today's boot camp is that you'll be a better and more successful uranium investor and speculator in the coming 1 or 2 years. Thank you very much and goodbye.